This podcast contains descriptions of alcohol and drug abuse, sexual assault, adult themes, violence, and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. On June 3rd, 2011, a young woman named Lauren Spear disappeared after a night out with friends at Indiana University, never to be seen again. As a fellow IU student who grew up with similar circumstances, her story has haunted me. There were so many nights my friends and I could have ended up like her. This is the story about what happened that fateful night at a historic university and a quaint Midwest town with a hidden dark side. This is Finding Lauren. I'll never forget arriving in Bloomington, Indiana in August 2011. The air was hot and humid as it normally is in those sleepy Midwest towns late in summer. The town, still empty from summer break but slowly starting to fill up, sounds of car doors slamming and sights of parents and students could be seen unloading boxes and suitcases. But something was different compared to the first time I visited Indiana and made the decision to transfer there for my sophomore year. It was darker, heavier. Lauren Spear had been missing for 2 months at that time. Her face was inescapable as missing posters were pasted all over the town and surrounding areas. Imagine arriving at the campus for the first time and seeing every shop window, every tree, and even the massive highway billboard as you drove into the quintessential college town covered with her face. A constant reminder that something more sinister was lurking in Hoosierville. This bubbly, 20-year-old student with piercing blue eyes, blonde hair, and her whole life ahead of her was nowhere to be found. My mom and I head up 9th and College Avenue towards the Smallwood Plaza apartment complex, the same apartment complex that Lauren Spearer lived in. That was to be my new home. We walked into the building. There was a stale air in the lobby and fluorescent lights illuminated even more missing posters than I had seen driving onto campus. The smell of old smoke and alcohol seeped into the elevators, indicative of an endless night out. A T-shape as you exit the elevator bank leading down what seemed like endless skinny paths. Living every parent's worst nightmare, my mom looked at me and said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" On June 3rd, 2011, Lauren Spear disappeared after a night out partying with a group of boys at Indiana University. She was never seen again. Lauren was reported to have been at three known locations throughout the night: her apartment, her friend's apartment complex, and a nearby bar. The furthest distance she traveled from one location to another was 0.4 miles. Her last known location was leaving her friend Jay Rosenbaum's apartment to walk home at around 4:30 in the morning. She wasn't even wearing shoes. According to the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, nearly 600,000 individuals go missing in the United States every year. It is estimated that 4,400 unidentified bodies are recovered each year. Although most are ultimately identified, that still leaves tens of thousands of individuals missing. Lauren Spearer is one of those people whose body has never been found and is still missing today. As a fellow student at the time, and with circumstances so close to my own, it's always been a haunting thought that this could have happened to me or anyone I know. Not to mention the synergy I felt when I decided to pursue telling this story. I found that two of my grandpa's confidants, Bo Deedle and Michael Cerevolo, were leading the investigation on behalf of the Spearer family. My grandpa, Jimmy Breslin, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist best known for his role in solving the infamous Son of Sam murders and his marriage to the New York Daily News. I've always felt inspired to follow in his footsteps. The PIs were former New York police detectives who have a long history of working with my grandpa when it came to reporting on crime, and my mom actually sat next to Bo at my grandpa's funeral. Although this case is extremely sensitive, this connection felt like a sign that I was embarking on something that I should. June 2nd, 2011 began like every other day. It was a Thursday, and IU Bloomington Summer School was in session. Students were getting ready to start their weekends. The spring semester ends in early May, but many students, including myself the following summer, stay for 4, 6, or 8 week sessions in what is called summer session. A way to pick up some additional credits, yes, but for many, a way to continue the party from the school year into the summer. Some people didn't want to leave and willingly stayed to enjoy the freedom and fun of Bloomington. The days were long, and so were the nights. What felt like a whirlwind of adventure and energy in the school year completely slowed down in the summer. It was hot and sticky. Days would start in the 70s and climb to the mid-80s and higher. It was 85 degrees the day Lauren Spearer went missing with extreme humidity. Most students only had one or two classes a day, which left a large number of hours to do pretty much whatever you wanted. This often meant drinking or getting high with your friends while you worked on your tan. What was different about summer session, as opposed to the regular school year, was its ability to bring students together. Some kids who lived in frat or sorority houses moved into off-campus apartments and befriended their neighbors. Many students took the same classes. And because the overall student population was just lower, you started to hang out with whoever was around, whether you were friends before or not. This is important in Lauren's story because she spent most of her night with a new friend, Corey Rossman. Imagine going from a bustling campus of about 40,000 students in the academic year to just about 12,000 during the summer. A town that thrives off of out-of-state students and residents becomes abnormally quiet as its main purpose is the school. When the students leave, you can really feel this shift of energy and become more aware of the locals, or townies. Due to the intense Midwest heat, we'd always look for ways to cool off. The apartment complex at 10th and College was the only building in the downtown Bloomington area that had a pool and was a party spot during the day. This is just a block away from where Lauren Spearer was last seen. It was also at the pool later that day on June 3rd, 2011, where Lauren's friends were all sitting together wondering why they hadn't heard from her and realized something was wrong. It has also been said that Jay Rosenbaum, the last known person to see Lauren, was at the pool the next day as well. The voices you are about to hear are former IU students. Out of respect for their privacy, their names are not being used.
Summer session was such a thing in Indiana. Everyone loved to stay. We always had such a good group of people. I had like 6 friends. We all lived in an apartment together after freshman year. That was that summer session. And it was almost like a continuation of college during the school year. Everyone would have their apartment parties. Everyone was going out. We would hang out by like the 10th and College pool during the days and go out at night. Like a typical, you know, it was a continuation of college. We were all at the pool. Everyone went out the night before. Her friends were at the pool too. Everyone hung out there. But I remember like one of her friends was like, yeah, we haven't heard from Lauren in a while. Maybe it was like 12 or 1 o'clock. I'm not sure what time it was. And they're like, but this is a little normal for her. Like maybe she's still sleeping or whatever else. And then we're still hanging out at the pool. And then later that day, they're like, we still haven't heard from Lauren. And they're like, maybe we should, you know, call the police or see what's going on. And I think they later on that day called the police and no one had heard from her. And that's when it all started.
What makes a lot of this case so difficult to understand is the intense secrecy and silence from anyone who might have been involved and the unwillingness for the Bloomington Police Department to release information to the public. Although it's not super unusual to keep information on an open investigation under wraps, in similar missing persons cases from college students across the country, it was in fact the decision of the police to release certain footage and information that kept people talking about the case and ultimately led to a resolution. I believe that in the case of Lauren Spearer, the lack of conversation all of these years later has been detrimental. I always wondered when listening to true crime podcasts or watching hours of Dateline why more hasn't been done on her. It's the craziest story, and a heartbreaking one. Sure, there have been a few one-off podcasts and a 2020 episode, but that's pretty much it, and it made no sense to me. It was with that I decided to help keep her story alive based off what I remember as a student during such a significant time. From a combination of statements given by the boys with Lauren that night, witness testimony, and limited surveillance footage, the FBI and investigators have created a timeline of where Lauren traveled that evening. Aside from the footage, the rest of the details about Lauren's timeline are limited. It seems that in this community, people in general do not want to discuss this case and want to just move forward. I've had difficulty getting sources to speak on the record, whether it be her family, friends, fellow reporters, and even a retired Bloomington police detective. Lauren Spears' night on June 2nd started as most nights so commonly do for a college student, with the pregame. Lauren left her apartment with a friend named David Roan, who also lived in the Smallwood apartment complex. David Roan was a student at Indiana University from New York City that ran in the same circle as Lauren and her friends. The story has it that Lauren and David walked up a few blocks to their friend Jay Rosenbaum's apartment at the 5 North Townhomes located on 11th between College and Morton Avenues. Just a 0.3-mile distance and about a 5-minute walk. A no-brainer if you're used to walking miles around campus or have grown up on the outskirts of New York City. Lauren Spear grew up in Scarsdale, New York, which is an affluent suburb just outside of Manhattan where I grew up. I have a ton of friends from Scarsdale. It breeds a lot of Hoosiers. It seemed to be a little on the later side for a pregame, but because the bars in Bloomington stay open until 3, you're never really in a rush. Lauren met up with a group of boys. Her boyfriend of 3 years at the time, Jesse Wolf, gave a statement that he stayed home that night to watch basketball, a totally normal guy thing to do. Jesse lived in a house just north of campus. His parents later gave a statement that he and Lauren were texting back and forth that evening, and she told him that she was at home and going to sleep. After that, he went to bed at around 2:30 a.m. Jesse was also the one to report Lauren missing the following day. Lauren Spearer and David Roan arrive at the 5 North Townhomes and were greeted by friends upon arriving at Jay Rosenbaum's. Jay had some friends visiting with him that weekend. Sean Cohen of the Journal News reported that at the pregame, there was a keg going and Belvedere vodka, as well as drugs in play. It has also been said from a variety of reports that in addition to drinking, Lauren had snorted an anti-anxiety medication known as Klonopin, or K-Pins, as many of the IU students recreationally referred to it. Here is an excerpt of Sean Cohen of the Journal News, who speaks with private investigators Bo Deedle and Michael Cerevolo. They recall the timeline of Lauren's night on the one-year anniversary of her disappearance.
Lauren Spear headed out of Smallwood Plaza, where she lives, shortly after midnight. She went up the street with David Roan to Jay Rosenbaum's apartment. He lives in a townhouse complex. About 10 people were gathered inside his apartment drinking. So, Jay said that a lot of the hard alcohol was already gone, that he had 6 to 10 shots of Belvedere vodka, but they still had a keg of beer going. We know that there were some drugs in use at the party or shortly beforehand. This is a gathering that goes on almost weekly. They call it pre-gaming. And at a certain point, about 1:30 in the morning, people headed out.
Pre-games were a very common occurrence that usually consisted of taking a lot of shots of vodka in a short period of time before going out. Depending on the vibe or the plan for the night, drugs often would find their way. Sometimes the pre-games were so much fun that you didn't even want to leave. I've also witnessed friends who went too hard at the pre-game and didn't make it out. They can't hang is what we jokingly say about our fallen soldiers. From my understanding of the situation, it was not a massive group of people at Jay's apartment, but the group did consist of some new friends, Corey Rossman and Mike Beth, who lived just a few doors down in the same townhouse complex, and whatever friends Jay had visiting from out of town. Corey had only met Lauren a few days prior at the Indy 500 in Indianapolis, which is one of the most iconic racing events that many IU students who stay for summer session visit. ABC reported that at Jay's pregame, Corey was the one encouraging Lauren to continue drinking with him just a few blocks away at Kilroy Sports Bar, or Sports, as we always called it. It was also noted how drunk Lauren already was at this point.
In general, at that time, it was like they let anyone in, everyone in. Everyone was always wasted. It was so fun. We had, like, our pregames were just as fun as the sports.
About an hour after arriving at the pregame, Lauren and Corey head to Kilroy Sports Bar, just about 0.4 miles or 8 minutes from the Five North townhomes.
Lauren Spear went two doors down to Corey Rossman's place, and the two of them went to Kilroy's together. A few of the others who were at the pregame also showed up.
On a normal college night, it's pretty rare for anyone to stay behind if the whole group is going to the bar. But because summer session is more low-key, it's not abnormal that some people decided to just stay and chill. At 1:46 a.m., Lauren is seen entering sports with Corey. This has been confirmed by surveillance footage from sports and also reported by the Bloomington police. Being that Lauren was only 20 years old at the time, she used a fake ID to get in. Kilroy Sports Bar faced major scrutiny letting in a minor who later disappeared, and as a result, the town doubled down on underage drinking by employing undercover cops to make sure no minors were entering under false pretenses. Obviously, this is the law, so that makes sense, but it had an unfavorable effect on the IU social scene. Trying to hold sports responsible for serving Lauren on the night she disappeared seemed to display this notion that the school and authorities were just focused on stopping partying overall rather than finding out what actually happened to Lauren. It's not a surprise that many students, including myself, still tried to enter sports before their 21st birthday knowing the risks. Eventually, when you did turn 21 in Bloomington, it was the biggest celebration ever because you no longer had to worry about getting arrested or getting your fake ID taken from you, which happened all the time. I honestly don't know what's worse at that age, because finding a good, real replacement is close to impossible. Going to the bars was our livelihood and an integral part of the IU social experience. It's what we did. Dealing with these repercussions as a result of Lauren's disappearance was unnerving and changed the dynamic of how systematic the partying was. On your average school night, Kilroy Sports Bar would have been absolutely slammed, with lines wrapping around the block and music pulsating from the speakers. On so many occasions, it would get to capacity and they'd have a one-for-one policy. It was known that you had to get there before midnight if you wanted to ensure your entry. They were also making cash hand over fist with their $5 cover at the door. Then, once you were in and settled downstairs, you waited until about 1:30 to go upstairs, where the fantastically loud rap music, bottle service, and dancing occurred, known as the jungle. A lot of the times you would need a wristband to even access the different levels. During the summer, it never truly gets to that level of absurdity. The summer months were a standstill as far as money-making goes because everything was just slower. That could be another reason why they were keen to let Lauren in, even with a fake ID. I remember thinking during my own summer session how desperate some of these bars must be to make money.
At the bar, Lauren took off her shoes, left her cell phone, walking around on the sandy lot that they have there to create kind of a beach effect. So we know that there was some more drinking going on at the bar. Corey Rossman and Lauren left together. They headed back to Smallwood Plaza, where Lauren lives.
Lauren and Corey stay at sports for about an hour, and at 2:27 a.m., surveillance footage captures the pair leaving the bar. Lauren is without her shoes. We also find out later that she is without her phone. Sports was known for being extremely festive, so to set the vibe as the months got warmer, they built a beach on the patio with fake sand and beach chairs. That is most likely the reason that she would have taken off her shoes, but the fact that she forgot them indicates just how intoxicated she was at this point. As for her phone, she was wearing black leggings, which don't allow you to put anything in your pockets, making it much easier for someone to lose their belongings. But to forget your phone when you're a person known to always be attached to it is a red flag. I remember choosing my outfits for the night based on my drinking. I'd ask myself questions like, which outfit would be the most practical and the most comfortable? Should I forego wearing heels and just wear boots so I can run around and not worry about my feet getting stepped on? Should I bring a bag or just wear jeans and use my pockets so my hands will be free? The only nights I have ever left anything at the bar were the nights that I can hardly remember. And I think based on the description of Lauren that evening is a fair assessment. Lauren and Corey head back to her apartment at Smallwood, which is just 2 blocks away and a 3-minute walk. At around 2:30 a.m., More surveillance footage from Smallwood Plaza captures Lauren and Corey entering the building. It also shows her visibly intoxicated to the point of being severely incapacitated. The two enter the elevator and head up to her apartment on the fifth floor. Smallwood Plaza is comprised of 223 residential apartment units. The entire complex took up a full square block and offered varying 2-, 3-, and 4-bedroom apartment units that essentially looked the same. Despite being relatively expensive for college apartments, they were extremely outdated and had been partied into death. The interiors were made up of beige shag carpeting lining the living rooms, fake wood paneling in the kitchen, and popcorn crackled ceilings. Each alternating floor had a different hue of orangey mustard color or beige on the walls, and the long hallways connected down differing paths like a maze. It was a complete melting pot of residents, athletes, East Coasters, and drug dealers. Some nights when I would get home, there would be puke in the lobby or the elevator or both. Always the smell of marijuana. There was always something going on. You could party hop and never leave the building.
Freshman year, I forgot why, but like a few of the boys our age lived in Smallwood. So we would always be there before we went out because it was so close to the bars. Because on campus, where everyone else was in the dorms, was far, and you'd have to take a taxi. And it was just, so we would go to the boys. It was just like everyone would stay there and sleep there. I remember there was four of them. There were two separate apartments that they lived in. And we were all just there. We would go there before the bars, after. And we usually went to sports. Yeah, we would always go back to Smallwood, and just everyone would just like sleep wherever they dropped. Like, I forget, honestly, ever going back to my dorm room. I don't even know where I went.
Upon entering the fifth floor, the pair is stopped by a group of boys. The one of significance is Zach Oakes, who was also a student at Indiana University, as well as three other boys whose identities have not been made public for some reason. According to the Spearers private investigators, Bo Deedle and Michael Cerevolo, Zach Oakes noticed the clear level of Lauren's intoxication and asked if she was okay. It has been reported that she could barely stand at that point. Multiple people from that night have also reported seeing her in an incoherent state by the elevator.
In the hallway, they were confronted by four guys who came up and saw that Lauren was in bad shape. One of them asked Lauren if she was okay, and Corey said, I got it. She's fine.
And
does he say?
And then the boy again says, "Hey, dude, you better take her to a room."
Same boy.
And Corey now gets mouthy and said, "Fuck you, I got it." And that's about enough for Zach Oakes. He's a tough kid, I hear. And one punch to the jaw, and Corey went down. And this is in the alcove of the elevator, where it's tile floor, not rug. So he went down maybe kind of hard.
This altercation supposedly really did a number on Corey. For whatever reason, the pair decided to leave and never entered her apartment, a detail that could have changed everything. Had they gone inside, maybe even just for 5 minutes, Lauren might still be here with us today. I've always wondered what it was they were going back to her apartment for anyway. Was Corey trying to take advantage of her, or were they possibly going to do the cocaine that was later found in her room when police searched her apartment? Did Zach pick up on some weird vibe from Corey and that's what led to the fight? Or maybe Corey really was just trying to walk her home safely. I knew a girl who dated Zach Oakes for a while in college, and from what I have heard, he seemed to be a well-liked guy who was also big on the party scene. He ran in a similar circle as Lauren and her boyfriend, and it could be inferred from the situation that he was not happy to see Lauren headed back to her apartment with another guy, especially in a state which she could have been taken advantage of. After 12 minutes at Smallwood, Lauren and Corey are on surveillance footage leaving the building. Lauren is shown stumbling out of the elevator in the building lobby despite Corey having been punched. She is still without shoes.
Corey and Lauren took the elevator down to the lobby, and Lauren came stumbling out of the elevator. So Corey was the one who got punched, but Lauren was the one who is, at least in the video, who needed all the help. This was one thing that seemed to contradict the version that's given by Corey Rossman and his lawyer. Corey claims he suffered short amnesia, that he doesn't even remember what happened, that 15 minutes before the fight, the punch, and for the rest of the evening, he has no memory of that. So they headed out together. They walked up the street and sat down along the way on a staircase.
They head up towards 5 North Townhomes to Corey's apartment. During that walk, they stopped and sat down on a staircase. This is where, according to Bo Deedle and Mike Saravolo, there is a witness, an older woman, reported seeing a very intoxicated Lauren seated on some steps, tip over, and hit her head on the concrete. Her fall made such a loud thud that it gained the witness's attention.
And that's where we have a female witness who was leaving, visiting a boy. She's not a college student. She's a little bit older. And she observed the young girl, which we now know to be Lauren, to tip over while she was sitting on the top step and hit her head on the concrete. And the boy was sitting a step or two below her.
And it was loud enough for her to hear.
You could hear the thud of
the thud of her head, yeah.
Corey then helps Lauren up, and the two continue to his apartment through an alley where she is seen on surveillance footage from cameras mounted on a nearby building falling a second time, face first. Lauren apparently didn't attempt to use her hands to stop the fall.
So Lauren and Corey headed up an alleyway from there, and Lauren is seen falling face first to the ground, hitting her head. She didn't even put up her hands to block herself. Corey helped her to her feet, and then just a few steps later, she crumbles again to the ground. And again, Corey helps her up, and they head up the street. So Lauren and Corey headed up an alleyway from there and head into an apartment building at 10th and College, knock on the door of four girls who were partying with them earlier in the night, but no one's home.
A minute later, the door opening and them going back down and him helping her with that kind of slung across his back.
Going down the stairs, he slings her, he puts her...
He has her arms like this in front of him, and he's bent over like this, and she's kind of dangling off his back.
She's not unconscious.
She was alive and well. But she was alive.
She has another seat, sits down and for about a minute. But at that point, she leaves her keys. She drops her keys and an ID card. And Corey helped her up the street to his apartment. Once they got inside his apartment, his roommate was inside. Mike Beth was home studying, and he had also done some drinking.
2:51 a.m. is the last time Lauren will be caught on camera. This footage was never released to the public. A disappointing move by the Bloomington police that has baffled all of us who are just trying to find answers. Or at least that was the general impression. Lauren and Corey arrived at Corey's apartment shortly afterward. Mike Beth, Corey's roommate, was at the apartment. According to statements that Mike made to the police, he had been home studying that evening. He reports seeing Lauren in the living room and said that Corey was also very intoxicated and stumbling, so much so that he vomited on the carpet on the way upstairs to his room. In the same statement, Mike said that he helped escort Corey to bed and claimed that Lauren was still trying to continue the night.
Mike Beth sees Lauren in the living room. He sees his roommate, Corey, walking up the steps, and Corey throws up on the carpet, and Mike Beth goes over and helps him up to his bedroom. This is what Mike Beth said. After putting Corey to his room, he comes down. He sees Lauren in the living room, and obviously she's in bad shape. And Mike Beth tries to get her to sleep over there.
And Lauren wanted to go. So with that, Mike Beth said, I don't know her as well as Jay Rosenbaum knows her. He knows her much better. They went to camp together.
Right, in Pennsylvania.
Right. So he walks her next door, and he makes her Jay Rosenbaum's problem.
There have been plenty of nights, especially when I moved into the sorority house on the other side of campus where I slept on the closest couch. I did anything not to have to find a way back late at night. Nothing sounded more miserable than finding yourself alone at the end of the night when your friends had either gone home with guys or passed out. Whether it be my girlfriends or my guy friends, I was always taken care of. Even if I was trying to continue the night, at some point you do just pass out, especially if you've been drinking heavily. In the mornings, my friends and I would always have a running chat of where everyone slept. Before going to get food, whoever felt like driving would round up the troops and pick them up from wherever they spent the night. We took care of each other. If Mike really felt that uncomfortable being responsible for a girl he hardly knew, I guess I can get behind that. But at the same time, if you're a good guy and she really is that out of it, it shouldn't be that hard to just get her to stay. It's hard to imagine someone who is falling over and hitting her head to be actively trying to continue her night and ignoring pleas to just chill. Jay Rosenbaum gave the statement that when Lauren arrived at his apartment, he observed a bruise or a lesion under her eye, presumably sustained from a fall earlier that evening. She told him she didn't know how she got the bruise. Although he had guests at his apartment, he too tried to get Lauren to stay on his couch.
And Jay is trying to get her to sleep over there. She won't have it. She wants to get her cell phone. She wants to leave. And at about 4:15 a.m., we learned that two calls were placed from Jay's phone, and the claim is that she made both calls, calling two friends, one of them David Roan, because she thought that he had her cell phone. Neither of the friends answered the phone, and that's when Lauren left.
That he watched her from his second floor balcony. And the balcony, if you passed his house, is about a foot and a half wide. You can't even fit a chair out there. But you could stand out there and smoke a cigarette, I guess. And he said he watched her from there.
So he could see her walking down the street? You saw the vantage point?
That's according to him, yes. And he says when she gets to the court, you know, he said he was able to see her almost until she got to the court.
At around 4:15 a.m., two calls were placed from Jay's phone shortly before she is said to have left. Jay said Lauren placed both calls. One was to David Roan, whose lawyer did not confirm this, and who is also on video returning to Smallwood, where he remained. And one to another friend. This second call has never been made known to the public. Neither picked up, and no messages were left. Lauren was supposedly reaching out to see if anyone knew where her phone was. Somewhere between 4:15 and 4:30, Jay reports that Lauren left his apartment. Jay says he watched Lauren leave and saw her at the intersection of 11th Street and College Avenue headed south on College. She was never seen again.
The private investigators say that there were a lot of conflicting statements that night, and they're not sure whether to attribute it only to the fact that maybe they were drinking, they were doing drugs, or to the fact that they're withholding information. They don't really have their story straight.
At around 4:35 in the morning, a known homeless man reportedly heard a woman scream just west of where Lauren Spearer was allegedly last seen. The Indianapolis Monthly reported that rumors of the scream began circulating shortly after news of Lauren's disappearance got out. A reporter from the Bloomington Herald-Times later looked into the claim, but it's not clear whether police ever ran down the tip. Speculation on the man's identity centered around a well-known Bloomington homeless man named Franklin Road Dog Crawford, who ironically died just a few days after Lauren's disappearance. He was found dead in a dumpster. He had literally been thrown away. Being a student at Indiana University after Lauren Spearer disappeared always felt like I was living in the shadow of a nightmare, and I think many people felt the same way, especially for the first couple of months after. Knowing that Lauren took her last known steps through the alleys we used to always cut across was daunting. I think of her walking down these same streets and have some out-of-body experience. Also, given that I lived in Smallwood and was always walking up to my best friend's apartment on 10th and College, sometimes even up to the new apartments on 11th and College, was another layer. It was the exact route she took. When my friends and I stayed for summer session the next summer, it was a running joke that when we walked home late at night, we'd walk in the middle of College Avenue to keep a fair distance from any potential strangers. When I leave friends' apartments on 11th and College, every time I was on that corner, there was just this vibe that something wasn't right. It's like moving into a house where you know someone has died there. It feels haunted. The timeline presented is what has been officially released and studied and obsessed over for the last 10 years. What is less known in this story are the events that led up to this evening and how that plays into what happened. It has been said that Lauren Spear's disappearance tells a story of a love triangle and several hours of drinking and drug use that might have spiraled out of control. We know Lauren was severely intoxicated that evening from multiple sources, but what I wish we could know more about was the days and weeks beforehand. What was that like? What kind of mental state was she in? Usually these details are key in helping to determine a missing person.
I met Lauren once at a friend's birthday party pregame, who was one of my really, really close girlfriends. And she went to high school with Lauren. And I remember just like saying hi. She was really, really nice and bubbly and so cute and little, but I didn't really like get deep with her or anything. It was just like we were at the same place, but I knew of her really well because of our friends. So I only met her that one time, but she was really a sweet girl. I remember my friend introducing her to me, like, this is my friend from home. I love her so much. And there was nothing out of the ordinary about her. Like, she was just sweet and nice and little.
According to an article by Scott Bernstein of the Macomb Daily, the weekend before Lauren went missing, Jay Rosenbaum introduced Lauren Spear to his neighbors Mike Beth and Corey Rossman. Not with her boyfriend Jesse Wolf at the time of the introduction, supposedly Lauren and Corey flirted with each other. Corey made it known to his friends the days leading up to her disappearance that he was interested in her romantically. Unfortunately, I wish I had more information about this, but as mentioned, it's been very hard to get people to open up. Everyone is so closed off. I've reached out to so many different sources for commentary. Most do not even answer, and the ones that do are reluctant to be upfront or divulge anything. Especially for friends we share, rehashing the pain of this experience is not something they want to continue doing. Aside from the copious amounts of booze and drugs Lauren is said to have ingested on the night she disappeared, another very important thing to be known here is that she suffered from a heart condition known as long QT syndrome, a condition that affects your heartbeat. It results in an increased risk of an irregular heartbeat, which can result in fainting, seizures, or sudden death, and these episodes can be triggered by exercise or stress. The combination of the substance mixing, a heart condition that requires medication, as well as her extremely petite size, seems like a recipe for disaster.
There was so much talk and so many conspiracy theories. The big one is that these boys were with her. Lauren was wasted and doing drugs all night, and then she overdosed because she was like 100 pounds or something, really little. She had a heart issue and she accidentally overdosed. So the rumor was that the boys got scared and took her body and like buried her in the woods, threw her out. I don't know, but I can't imagine, like thinking about like the boys our age, could you imagine them doing that? That's what because it's the same scene. I just don't.
The timeline of her night leaves me with so many questions. Where do the boys who have conflicting statements come into play with this? Who was the other phone call made to from Jay's phone? Did Lauren even make those calls? Why wouldn't Jay walk her home if she was without shoes and in such an inebriated state? I'm also so curious about her heart condition. How had she experienced drinking and taking medication for her condition in the past? Based on conversations I've had with Sean Cohen, the heart condition was serious enough for her to have to stop playing sports in high school. Here you have this young woman who's been told for most of her life not to push the envelope, that by the time she got to college, that's all she wanted to do. But again, does that make any of this her fault? Or that she deserved this based off her choice of behavior? Does that justify the fact that she is gone? She was doing what every other college kid does, especially at Indiana University. Was this a horrible accident, or was it something more sinister? On the next episode of Finding Morin.
We were so young, like, it was our first time in a big school without anyone watching us and telling us what to do. And I think when you're a freshman, it's really like, it's fun, but it's also, you're testing your limits.
After I saw that coming back, I was like, oh, maybe this isn't so safe.
I remember like a few girls always took like Xanax before we would go out.
The new normal when people go to college can be very dangerous depending on where you are and the people you decide to befriend.
Lauren Spear's case is still an open investigation. Anyone with information regarding her disappearance, please reach out to Bo Deedle and Associates. For updates from her family, follow the official Lauren Spear updates page on Facebook. Finding Lauren is hosted and produced by me, Kira Breslin. Edited by J. Cody Spellman. Engineering and original music by Monty Weber. Logo design by Josh Stauffer. Special thanks to USA Today Networks for use of media. For links to sources, clips, and more information, you can follow at Finding Lauren Podcast on Instagram.